We've been asked to talk about three words, and I don't particularly want to talk about these three words at all. I'm going to talk about them very quickly and shortly, because they can actually be compared in the dictionary fairly easily. And the three words are inspiration, aspiration, and ambition. I'll put down the basic idea in the inspiration and the aspiration thing, in the aspiring. You know that the letter H is said to be an aspirate letter, and of course it symbolizes the breath, or life principle in the body and in the universe itself. But this fire in the spire is a word meaning fire and also meaning reason. And we're going to examine why this same word should be used to signify two apparently opposite things. We said before that when Jesus made his entrance, he said, "Think not that I am come to bring peace, but a sword." And he was bringing a fiery sword, an energy sword, with a reason involved in the energy. Now, if we spell this fire with a Y, we're spelling it like the Greeks spelled fire. We know that we sound shift P into F, so we've got our English word fire and the word fur as in fir tree. And the fir tree is so called because it is shaped more or less like a flame. It's really a fire tree. If we examine the nature of energy, energy is that which is affirming work in itself. The N is the same as in. The erg means work, and the Y at the end means affirmation. It is the affirmer of work inside. Now, whenever energy moves, it necessarily moves in some manner. And the manner in which it moves, we can call its formal expression. It's formal self-objectification. Supposing we draw a line to represent a movement of energy. This movement of energy must close upon itself to deserve the hard G. We can use the word force if we like. Again, it's FR. In force, fire, fierce. If we don't close the system, we can say, we don't know what to call it, because we haven't really a word for calling it something without suggesting closure. Because when we come to observe emotion at all, the fact of observation is the fact of finiting. When we write the of in observation, we've written a word that means a sphere. It's the same as the word of, except that an of with the letter R in means an of or sphere for ruling purposes. The orb of rulership is simply a sphere which has been carefully differentiated, like the process of mitosis, which differentiates a single cell into many cells. Orb becomes orb by differentiation within itself. When this energy moves, it moves necessarily in some manner. Manner is from the base ma to measure. And therefore it means that when energy moves, we can measure it, and we can use it as a unit one of the forms of motion. A very convenient form of motion is a wave. We draw a median line, a straight line, to represent a plane of equilibrium, and then we draw a curve over it, a semicircle, and one beneath it. This can be used to represent one primary wave on this basic equilibrated continuum. Imagine we draw the surface of the water. This is like the face of the waters in the book of Genesis. And the Spirit of God moves on the face of the waters, on the surface of the cosmic ocean. And when it moves, it produces prime ripple. This wave section diagram can be taken as a prime ripple. You know that when wind or spiritus blows on water, it makes the water ripple. And the first ripples that it produces are very short wave and high frequency. And this is terribly important. It means that the musical world should start counting at the top and not at the bottom of the scale. The high frequency, short wave, precedes the low frequency, long wave in the universe. Now we can use this high frequency as a unit to measure any subsequent longer frequencies. Science is looking for an ultimate unit. Once upon a time it used arbitrary units, like a hand or a foot, or a yard, and these things are arbitrary measurements chosen basically from facts of human nature. A foot, once upon a time, was a measure of an adult man's foot. And it's rather arbitrary, and therefore averages of various feet had to be taken, and the thing settled down at what we call 12 inches. Inching along with moving your foot a very little bit at a time. And somewhere about 12 of these little movements to one movement you could make if you were going to move appreciably at all. So we talk about this inching along, meaning moving in little power quanta. Now let us take this first frequency that is produced in the absolute field as our basic unit, and we can then proceed to add the universe up, to measure the universe in terms of these primary units. When the motion is being measured in terms of these units, we see immediately that we have to start at a point, that's an SP, P posits, a point from which we start to measure. And then we pass from the positing point to differentiate from that point. Now in space being three-dimensional, we can measure from any point arbitrarily chosen in any direction. And to keep these directions few in number, they were broken down into six directions at right angles to each other, north, south, east and west, and up and down. Now if we like to draw a sphere, we put an equator on it and the polar axis, we can talk about the north direction, the south direction, the east direction, the west direction, the up and the down. This will give us six directions, and we can measure these from a central point. Now if we measure equal distances from this central point in all these six directions, and then describe lines round those equal radial measurements, we will describe for ourselves the skeleton of the sphere. If we rotate these lines that we have drawn round their centers at right angles to themselves, each plane rotating at right angles, we will describe a sphere of forces. We can easily imagine this point to send out from itself ripples, like a pebble does on the surface of water, and to send these ripples out in three directions at right angles to each other. And we divide these three directions into two by saying east-west on the equatorial plane, north-south across, and the up-down sky to ground. And when we put this system of ripples together and spin it, we have generated a sphere of influence of force. And in so doing, we have brought into being a form. Now the word form is like the word form, P to F, there is the R again. We put an O in it to symbolize the circumscribing of the zone to be measured, and we put an M at the end to signify the substantialization of this sphere. Now, this is telling us that every time energy moves, in moving in a formal manner, it becomes subject to measurement. And in becoming subject to measurement in this sixfold manner, northwest, east, south, up, down, that it becomes a geometrical proposition. We find then that we can analyze the behavior of energy in terms of geometrical concepts. And these geometrical concepts we represent with pi ratio, the pi r function. We've done this before, and we'll do it again in a simple way. Imagine the surface of a pond, to be struck by a pebble and the ripples to radiate from the center outwards to the perimeter of the pond and back again to the center. And we imagine that this pebble has been dropped from a height, and we will write the geometrical function, the pi ratio function, on this equatorial plane, the horizontal plane, and we'll write the hierarchical function on the vertical plane. We will say that the H function means the amount of energy in the falling stone, and the pi function is the amount of horizontal plane disturbance resulting from it. So there's a relation between the power and the formal behavior produced by that power. So there's a relation between hierarchy and geometrical coverage of form. And this gives us the basic ground for all authorities, whatever, whether individual or social. Inside an individual human being, we have the fact that certain centers of that being, if cut out, result in the immediate death of that being, whereas other centers, large tracts of tissue, can be cut away without the being dying. There are certain centers of initiative in the being, which are quite small, but if they are removed, there is no initiative left in that being. And there are other large masses of cell tissue in the body which can be removed without, in any sense, impairing the initiative centers. So we have to say that in the body, we can conceive a kind of pyramid, a pyramid, and a hierarchy of parts. Somewhere in the organism, there is a center of initiative power giving orders to a much larger mass which lacks initiative. This is the pattern for the individual human being, and individual human beings are simply one original individual human being parted by cellular division. And therefore, the rule of hierarchy and pi-rationality in beings, individual and social, individual and collective, is the same law. The law is quite a simple law, namely that every time energy moves, it necessarily moves in some formal manner, and therefore we can determine by the form the amount of energy involved in it. This is what Jesus meant when he said, by their fruits you shall know them. This is another PRFR word, fruit. By their forms of energy, by their manifestations, you can infer the type of hierarchy established in that being. Now, when we come to consider the word aspiration, we're talking about the spiraling upwards of energies, climbing up and up the hierarchical scale to try to get to the top. One aspires upwards. One aspires to increase of power. We have another word, suspiring. This is like going underneath, piling down instead of up. The word inspire means that the movement of spiraling, or rotating and climbing, has started from the center of the being and is beginning to move out to express itself. So we say a person is inspired when the form of their activity is rather an unusually brilliant one, but it is seen that no external force can account for its manifestation, and yet it is coming. And therefore we have to say that there is no external force causative of this motion. It must have an internal source, and this we call the inspiration. The spiration that begins inside the being. Now, inspiration can be said to be a good thing because it is an essential self-expression. Aspiration is a good thing because it means that one is climbing up and increasing power. Now let's compare this with ambition. Ambition implies a duality within the being. This ambi implies duality. A person who is ambitious is already cut in two. In a peculiar way, the being with a hierarchical concept is a unity because he believes in the subordination of powers to higher powers, of intelligence to higher intelligence, and so on. And he knows that it is impossible to produce an order without passive and active, without givers of impulses and receivers of impulses. He knows that nothing whatever of the structure that we call valuable can arise other than by a hierarchy of power. He knows that every being which is to control himself, that is to say, become self-determined of his own action, he must order his own cells about. Certain of the cells in the body like pleasure, certain of them like rest. Some of them like to give orders, and some of them will have to be obeyed, because if they are not obeyed, the being will never attain the freedom from the dictating powers from outside the system. There's a short circle to represent any individual being, and the dot to represent the center of its initiation. It initiates a movement from within itself, and this movement from within itself, if it were the only being in the universe, would be uncontradicted. It would simply move out and continuously expand. But this would involve that it were being supplied by an infinite energy source from beyond itself. But if there is an other force beyond itself, then we have to posit the possibility of other centers also doing exactly the same thing. In the world as we see it, we see centers of impulse throughout the universe. We see that each center is giving orders and is surrounded by millions of other centers also giving orders. So if you look at the cells in a living being, the subdivisions of the original cell, you find they have a little nuclear center which is busy giving orders. And the orders that it gives are orders related to its own function. We know that in certain kinds of cells, when they escape the ordering principle of the higher intelligence, they become what we call malignant. They go on their own sweet way, and they no longer harmonize their function with the rest of the body, and we say we have a malignant growth inside the body. But this malignant growth is only some cells who have started giving orders without regard to the central control. Now, if the cells of a cancer give orders, and they give orders more powerfully than the central control in the intelligence center in the brain, well, then the cancer wins and the man dies. And always it is an either-or. For any given finite system, the orders must come from inside it to control its behavior, or they will come from outside to control its behavior. There is no middle course. Between self-control and control by forces beyond oneself, there is no maybe, there is no middle. Jesus said this very clearly when he said, let your yea be yea and your nay nay. All else comes of the devil. That is to say, comes of the forces of disruption. The devil is the personification of the forces of disintegration. If we can order our organism from within our own body, that is, control our own reflexes, determine our own feedback systems, as we say these days, then while we are doing this, we are liberating ourselves from the control that would otherwise be placed upon us by other systems beyond ourselves. Now, in principle, every being is faced with this problem. Shall I control myself, or shall I accept the controls placed upon me by other beings? This is an either-or. If we say, I accept the controls placed upon me by other beings, I affirm the existence of the welfare state and other such bodies, then we can begin to relax and degenerate down to the level for merely passive beings. But if we do not want to do this, we will have to practice in becoming more and more self-determined. We must learn how our organism works in order to liberate ourselves from the merely mechanical reactive tendencies existent in any finite body. When we learn how to do this, we are extricating ourselves from a position of subordination to other forces. Now, in the human race, we have a tradition that talks quite a lot about reason, which is the pi ratio function, and about hierarchy, which is about degrees of power. We find that the word hieros, which is translated priest, originally meant a man who was very, very conscious of degrees of power and who saw the necessity for these degrees of power and preferred to be at the top. He knew one either gives orders to oneself or one takes them from others. Now, the original hierarchic mentalities had enough sense to know that the principle was not whether I should order other people about or they should order me about, but whether I should order myself about or how the beings order me about. The great error of the dictators is to think that either I order you about or you order me about. The real thing is whether I order myself about or whether you order me about. I don't have to order you about. If I can in fact control myself, I can order myself about and leave you to order yourself about, so that I just do not take any notice of your orders to me, and I live from my own center. But I refuse to impose on your center, and I leave you to decide whether you will be imposed on by you or by some other being. So the highest hierarch, or degrees of power conscious man, who knows that power governs, will in fact reject the offer of the subordination of other beings to himself, and he will say to them, I am not being ordered about by you, and therefore I require you not to want me to order you about. You must go into your own center. Because if any man accepts the complete subjection of all other beings to himself, he must then become entirely subordinated to the needs of those beings. And if there are myriads and myriads of such beings, he must become a doorway to myriads and myriads of desire fulfillment for all those beings. And this is the kind of ideal where you get the theological statement that Christ is all things to all men. But this doesn't mean that he will let you win the pools if you ask him nicely. Because if everybody starts praying the same week for the same prize, and there's only one supreme prize, they can't all have it. There's an inherent self-contradiction in the prayers of finite beings for infinite fulfillment for everybody. In America, there is a body of people that solemnly say that if you learn scientific prayer, you too can have a Studebaker. And if all the millions in America were to practice the scientific prayer efficiently, there would be no road space for the cars. Now, hierarchy, however, says that the degrees of power are vested ultimately in the absolute. The absolute is all-powerful precisely because it refuses to finite itself. We've represented this absolute by the paper, imagine it to be infinitely extended, and the movement of this paper we represent by drawing lines on the paper, and the lines we draw cross over each other and they make zones of finite activity. Each finite zone of activity is an individual being, and that individual being is a power function, and therefore under the law of hierarchy, and it is a pi ratio function, and therefore subject to geometrical and mathematical analysis. Now, if we say the S in the spirit, or in the word inspiration, aspiration, and so on, this S is originally a drawing of a serpent. So if we write S fire, it means fiery serpent. You find these fiery serpents quite a lot in the New Testament, quite a lot in the Old Testament. And a very solemn warning about individual fiery serpents is issued, because they go about spiraling, come spiraling, to subject all beings that are unaware of their own SP function. Now, this serpent was originally a symbol of an undulating motion, and that undulating motion is not a closed motion, and therefore is the motion that is particularly characteristic of the absolute or source motion of all other motions. The name of this running serpent used to be Anna. Anna is a girl's name derived from this, and it means running serpent. The name of the same serpent with its tail in its mouth was called On. This is the same On in Babel, On and On Heliopolis of the Egyptians. When the serpent closes itself, when this energy rotates, it circumscribes itself and becomes a finite being. And in so doing, it has abandoned the free motion of the absolute undulation. It has gained objectivity by closing itself, but it has lost the free notion of the absolute. Now, we write dome inside the on or close snake, and we write free beyond it. Now, this word free implies there has been a positing, a pi-rational function here, and an escape. This E after the FR is the energy of the field which is escaping the closure. In the sign of Taurus in the zodiac, we have a very simple illustration of this. We draw this Taurus sign, we put an arrow to show it goes in, and it goes out again. Now, when it is before going in, it has no name at all. This is a nameless null being prior to the generation of a circle. But when it has been in the circle, then it receives the name, he who comes out of the circle. In the Tao Te King, that which was before heaven and earth has no name. That which is posterior to heaven and earth has a name. So in our chemical psychology, we find that the sign of Saturn is placed inside the closed system as it is moving to the center, but the sign of Jupiter is placed on the outgoing motion. Jupiter is God the Father, Saturn is the devil or closure system. Until this closure is developed, there is no measurement possible, no mensuration, therefore no evaluation, and therefore no value. St. Paul puts this in the statement, before the law there was no sin. Now the law is simply the formal expression of power. The way power is laid down is the law for the being. When any being comes into existence, it does so by power pressing in to a finite zone and beginning to rotate. And the way in which that power runs itself into self-bondage, self-objectification, is because it is laid down by that being, the law of that being. The law is simply the formal way that power lays itself down in any given being. So prior to this laying down of the law, there can be no sin, because there has been no definition whatever. But once this definition has been made, then there is a possibility of sin, that is, a possibility of failing to realize the ultimate purpose. If we get inside the closure, we can become so identified with it that we begin to feel it as a restriction, and we may begin to believe that we cannot get out of this restriction. And we may find that in this process of self-objectification, which might mean anything from getting born in a physical body or getting a job which looks promising and turns out to be merely a dead end, by becoming famous in some given field, and then time, so that nobody will allow you to move outside your chosen field of self-expression. When you get into this field, you may become so involved in it that you have no extra energy to get out of it. And when this happens, you begin to interpret your chosen function, your self-objectification, as bondage. You begin to fail at it. It may be deficient in some way. And then you groan and travail means actually work the veils off yourself. You complain bitterly about this, and you wish to escape the limitations of this self-objectification. And this wish to escape is called the impulse of God the Father calling you back into the free spirit that you were in prior to your self-objectification. So this movement outwards from the bondage is symbolized as God the Father. It is God the Father as an object of worship only for the being inside the closed system. For the same amount of force or spirit, prior to that closure, it was not called God, because that force was not different from that field of infinite force beyond. This God only becomes God when a worshipper comes to exist. And this worshipper only comes to exist by a self-finiting, self-objectification process. So that only in so far as we impose on ourselves a definition of finity and relative deficiency of knowledge or physical function, only in so far as we impose upon ourselves in this way, do we give rise to the concept of a God as worthy of attainment. And in this sense, we can see that the sense of deficiency in our individual existence is terribly valuable, because it is the means whereby we generate the concepts of transcendence, the ideas that there is something greater than we are towards which we can strive. In other words, we can have no high ideal of where to go unless we have imposed on ourselves a deficiency in that field to make us aware that there is something greater than ourselves. Well, in the general principles of dialectics, we say that the movement of a force involves, turns into itself, wills into itself, self-objectification, but prior to this objectification, it has no concept whatever of what is going to happen during this self-objectification. Before this self-objectification, this sentient power, this spirit, does not know what is going to happen in the self-objectification process. So that it moves towards self-objectification as to finding itself and finding its own function. In other words, it is delighted in itself and in the way it is involved in itself in manifestation. But at certain crucial points in its process of self-involvement, it becomes aware that it is getting progressively more and more hemmed in by its own activity, by its own self-definition. And at this point, it begins to become rather nervous of going to the term of self-objectification. That is, it feels itself in having chosen a particular course or a particular body to have imposed upon itself a limitation which is leading to greater and greater deficiency and unpleasantness to itself. Now, if it is very unfortunate, it detects this early enough to pull out. If it can detect the amount of pain, the amount of inconvenience, the amount of self-limitation that it will have at a later date, if it can detect this early enough to pull out, it will attempt to do so. If it does so, it fails to objectify itself, and it is not a prodigal son. It will remain remarkably sensitive to the possibility of imposed limitations, but it will never be imposed upon, and it will become an artful dodger. It will always dodge the painful and the limiting situation. But if it is lucky and remains sufficiently ignorant or willfully disregards the imposed limitations upon itself, it will gradually become so involved that it forgets that it is really a free being. And in experiencing this state of forgetfulness, it will work very, very hard to extricate itself by an objective process of devising means of release other than backing out. In other words, it will devise means whereby it goes through the situation instead of backing out from the situation. The whole movement of man's science has been produced by this will to go through instead of to back out. If the original fallen angels or spiritual intelligences which had involved in matter had not committed themselves into darkness and ignorance, if they had managed to retain a little awareness of their divine origin sufficiently, they would have not fallen very far. They would have gone back to heaven very quickly, and they would have been as ignorant now as they were then. Luckily, many of them developed sufficient inertias to forget that spirit exists at all, and to become so objectified that they believe, like many believe today, that there is no intelligence beyond that of individual human beings. These are the beings we call humanists. They believe that individual human beings can solve individual human problems, and that they might even go so far as to solve universal problems by persistent carrying along of the fruits of their experience and passing these fruits from generation to generation. Now, the humanist, in principle, is a man who believes that he is self-objectified intelligence. The evolutionary humanists are a bit off the beam because they actually think their intelligence is of a higher order than the intelligence with which they started. They believe that they started as low intelligences in matter, and they are clambering out by a process of self-perfection, and that they will ultimately solve all problems and reach the top level of intelligence, having started at the bottom. Now, this is quite logically impossible. To reach the highest, they must have come from the highest. To evolve from the material world, they must have involved. And that, as water can never go higher than its source, because its source is the root of the pressure that it develops. So likewise, a human being can never rise to universal or cosmic or even absolute understanding other than by the fact of remembering, making again a member of his awareness, his origination in absolute spirit itself. This is why it is said that the spirit of man searches even the deep things of God. The spark of intelligence in man, if it becomes conscious that it is in fact field sentient power in the place of that reference body, the body that he starts with, if he realizes that this field power is his intelligence, and his intelligence is this field, and this physical body is merely a finite function within the field, then in identifying with the field, he gains the omniscience that he had before he identified with the body. Now, the man of ambition is always considering that he has to do something better than another. He is essentially a dualist. He sees his life as a war against other beings. Let's draw a circle, and let's divide the circle in two, and we'll shade the sinister half of it dark, and in the dark half we'll put secret intentions that this being has, and he wants no other being to know. His secret intentions are that he will rise over other beings, and he will dictate to other beings, and he will have glory for other beings, and more TV sets and carpets and fridges and so on. All of these are his secret intent. And because it is a secret intent, and because he has to learn to keep his face straight in the presence of his imagined enemies, therefore he learns to deceive himself. You know that when a small child tells its first lie, it does so because it doesn't want its mother to know what it is doing. And the mother normally commits a very grave error. She looks at the child and says, "I can tell by your eyes that you are lying." Straight away the child runs away, stands before the mirror, gazes into its eyes, and practices steady gazing. Now, in order to practice steady gazing, one must stop the thought process in the mind, because if we feel guilty, our eyes look guilty. So we have to learn that small boys and girls, some of us as both, we have to learn these things by practice. We have to learn to hide from ourselves the consciousness of guilt. Because if we don't hide it, then it will show, and Mama will say, "I can tell by your eyes you are lying." So we practice, and we hide from ourselves the sense of guilt. And by so doing, we develop the frank open gaze of the habitual liar. Now, when we have gained this, in order to do it, we've hidden the guilt from ourselves. We now are ambitious. We are twofold. We have secret intentions, and we have a facade of righteousness. Now this is doomed to fail. The ambitious person, because he is dualistic, because he has hidden from himself his intent, is really at war with himself. He's not one man, he's two men. And a house divided against itself shall not stand. In opposition to this ambitious man, let's look at a man who sees the truth, and we'll divide him into two in a different way. We've divided this ambitious man with his sinister half shaded to cover up his secret intention. We'll divide the other man by putting a small circle in the middle of a large circle. But this man is not ambitious. He is merely an inspired man who is aspiring to greater inspirations. This man says, "I am dividing myself into a being with a perimeter and a center and a zone between." And he knows this. He has no secret intention from himself. He says, inside myself there is energy. This energy goes out to produce distortions of form of the body, which mean muscular movements in our sense, until an amoeba actually means changes of shape, the extrusion of pseudopodia and so on. By distorting the body, we move. Now, this being of inspiration, is firing from within, or turning, applying energies, and these energies are formulating its being from within. It is not self-deceived, and it knows that there is another being outside it called ambitious being, and this being is acting upon its perimeter from outside. And it is trying by external stimuli to condition the responses of this inspirational being. The ambitious man is trying to dictate to the inspirational man, but the inspirational man knows that the ambitious man exists. And he also knows the ambitious man must fail in his project wherever inspirational man exists. Because the inspirational man can feel in himself whether he has initiated the movement that is being conducted by his body from within, or whether that movement is a tendency in his body arising from stimulation from outside. Now, if it is a stimulation from outside, to the inspirational man, it won't do. He can modify his behavior in relation to that stimulus intelligently, but he will never be dictated to by the external stimulus situation. This is the difference between the ambitious man, who is cut in two by his own purpose, and the inspirational man, who has no such purpose as the ambitious man. The inspirational man, going from his own center and knowing what it means to express from one's own center, that it means an absolute perfection of function from inside, that it means perfect happiness, perfect self-awareness, he refuses to impose on another being from outside, and he merely waits for that being to learn that he has a center inside himself. Now, this is what we mean when we talk about the higher ethics. A little earlier this evening, a few of us were discussing the possibility of a power higher than two powers to resolve a problem between two finites. If we imagine the original protoplasm of the human race, and we mark it HP for human protoplasm, and we then split this into two halves, we write HP in each. Now, the authority in the original protoplasm is still the authority in that protoplasm if that protoplasm divides itself with a cell wall. It is still the same if the two halves split. You know that when they divide, it makes a sort of dumbbell shape out of itself. That's significant too. And then it cuts across the narrow bit and turns into two beings. But the authority in each being is exactly equal. So that each being should go from its own center if it is to fulfill its own inner inspiration. Neither of those beings has a right from its own center to dictate the function of the other center, because these are exactly equal in their essential character. But if these two come into two different environments, because one lives on mountain range up here and the other lives on the plain, this one on the plain is developing, subdividing and making children. This one on the mountains is doing the same. The one that lives on the mountains and yodels horribly in the middle of the night may be imposing a terrible noise on the perimeter of the fellow in the valley. But then the fellow in the valley may be humming a monotonous tone and distressing the yodeler above. Now, neither of these has any inner right to stop the other doing what he's doing, other than that which he can in fact express as a sheer victory in opposition of power. Imagine that the fellow on the mountaintop has less to eat than the fellow in the valley. This is roughly a historical fact. All the nice soil of the mountains has been washed down by the rain, and simply that the lorries and the great big lettuces drained down here, and only edelweiss up here. Now, the fellows in the plains are getting more food, because food, eating, and sexual expressions are intimately linked, breeds more rapidly than the other fellow, he gets more children, bigger and best children, and so on. And he spreads out and makes the valley cultures. And because he's an agriculturalist, he learns about the rhythmical cycles of moon and sun and so on, because these are an essential part of his agricultural cycle. And he begins to spread further and further, and he may invade the lowlands and so on. Now, the fellows in the valley begin to see these fellows above as limiting factors on their expression. The very richest people occupy the richest parts of the valley. That's how we know they're rich. They always go on the southwest of the nice town. And the poorer ones are pushed gradually away. The later born ones have to move out. And the men in the mountains begin to look upon them as potential enemies. Now their authority, essentially, is identical. Only the fact of their experience is going to decide which of these two is more valuable. Now Jesus on one occasion said that we are worth more than many sparrows. This was a quantitative statement, and he meant to say that we have more cells in our body than sparrows have, that we have a more complex nervous organization than a sparrow, that our capacity for response to a variety of different situations is greater than that of a sparrow. So it's in terms of sheer function we have a greater value than a sparrow. Now ultimately, the one with the greatest response capacity is the one that will win. And in any given situation where these two fight, barring accidents like sudden earthquakes or acts of God, the victor is the one who should win because he won. He also is the one who writes the books and defines the other fellow as the wrong. We find historically that all the books that have been written by victors have defined the conquered peoples as unright to have opposed them. It is always the victory of right over wrong, good over evil, in the history books, because the victors have written the books. Now, a question is put here at this point. Surely there must be some authority above these two, which in fact has superior knowledge to them and therefore dictates to them a higher ethic. And we say, yes, of course, there must be something higher than these two if we finite our understanding down to their level, because the man on the mountaintop is deficient in the knowledge of the valley dweller, and the man in the valley is deficient in knowledge of the mountain dweller. And therefore we can say a man that would run up and down the mountains and in the valleys and gain all the information of all the different kinds of terrain there are would have a greater response capacity and therefore be more valuable than either of these two in isolation. And that this man with the greatest response capacity would be the higher intelligence which would decide what was ethical to do with either of the first two. In other words, if we get a group of human beings, sort of out with boundary school, with certain factors eliminated, and we allowed the pupils in this school to go all over the earth and to have experience in every conceivable kind of situation, society, terrain, and so on, and thus increase their response capacities so that their response capacities were way above that of the ordinary politician in the local council. Then we would say he is a higher man and he would in fact arbitrate and decide on matters of ethics. And we know that moral, it means only customary, and the customs relate to the way in which determined impulses have been cased in order to make society possible. So that morality is no higher than a man's belly. Ethics is higher. Ethics is a Greek concept. and means as high as your reason will take you. But your reason will only take you as far as measurement can take you. It will only deal with that which you have already measured. And therefore there must be an existential being to embody this reason. Because the unembodied reason, from the point of view of a finite individual, is no reason at all. Let's compare two concepts from Indian philosophy here. Shankara, a great non-dualist, he talked about the absolute as being utterly beyond all pairs of opposite concepts. So high and low, near and far, hot and cold and so on, cannot apply to this absolute source of the universe. And he said this absolute source is really beyond expression. But the nearest thing we can say about it is that it is sentient and that it is power. This sentience is Shiva and this power is Shakti. This is the God who himself is pure consciousness and his wife or consort who is his power. These are two aspects. And these two aspects cannot in any sense be separated in the absolute, and they absolutely transcend any objectification whatever. So that we cannot say of this absolute that it is a god in the sense of an object of worship. This absolute, this para-brahma, this beyond all considerations of God, is an infinite sentient power, non-objective. Now, if it doesn't objectify, it's like having that sheet of white paper with nothing drawn on it and nothing said about it, because nothing is drawn on it. Nevertheless, it is the ultimate ground of the possibility of objectification. And when it moves, the undulations of that moving are like the breathing of that infinite ocean of sentient power. And in the motions travelling through it, as they begin to cross each other, so they begin to bring to be a zone of rotation, or a sphere. Now this sphere becomes the god for subsequent worshippers. But this god is not absolute. Another man, Ramanuja, who was a monist, as opposed to a non-dualist, said Shankara's concept of non-dualism is so much beyond the level at which individuals can utilize it that it is, as it were, non-existent. To which Shankara replied, that is just what it is. Existent means finite, and this is not. Therefore, it is not an object of worship. It is that which, if we scrub out all the objects that we know of and retain the consciousness and the power without the objectifications, we ourselves shall, but we cannot say be, because be implies circumscription, finiting and individuation. So that it is absolutely beyond all that we mean by concepts of value. This is so high, there is no higher philosophy than this. It is so high it won't do for the working man or for the businessman or for the politician himself. He needs a nice big sphere than which there is drawn no bigger, and inside this sphere we can draw other spheres, and inside these we can draw other spheres, and so on. Every time we draw another little sphere inside the big one, we are cutting down smaller and smaller until we are coming down to subatomic vortical actions, or wavicles, as Schrodinger would call them. Little moments of force expression within the infinite. Now, in relation to any one of these small circles, a circle larger, embracing it, out of whose control it cannot step, is for it a god. That is a good. It is called a good because it enables it to exist, and it circumscribes and sets the limit to its will. So that there is a hierarchy of little spheres of influence, little individuals contained within larger individuals. And these larger ones are contained in larger ones still, and these are contained in larger ones still, until we come up to our limiting concept, which we retain, of a supersphere, the macrocosmic sphere. And this one shall be the God. This is the Ishvara, the God of worshippers. This is the Lord of the universe. And Lord means working principle of order. And beyond this working principle of order, there is the infinity of the absolute sentient power. The absolute sentient power is not an object of worship. It is the essential consciousness and will of man, with all the limiting factors removed, but cannot stand as an object because it cannot be finite. Nevertheless, any finite being within these rotating systems can, through a progressive process of self-development or removing the veils of illusion from its own understanding, begin to realize that the limiting factor which is restraining its activities is itself limited by a larger one. So that I, as a ratepayer within a certain city, realize that the men that collect the rates are as much circumscribed by another power beyond them, who take off them a large percentage of what they have taken off me, and this particular group have the money taken off them by a larger group, and so on. And if I translate money into energy symbols, then all these different levels of being are paying back energy to the source from which they got it. And the source of all these, as an object, is this macrocosmic Lord, or objectified God. This is the second God in the Gospel of St. John. The A God as opposed to the God. Now, if I know that this circle, by pure logic, has brought into being infinity, and by so doing has defined infinity as absolutely transcending itself, then I know that the presence of this circle, containing sentient power, containing selves positive, has its origin in the infinite. And I know, therefore, that if I wish to ally myself with the highest powers, I must ally myself with the absolute rather than any given expression of it. Now, in this opposition between the two religions of non-dualism and of monism, the statement is made by the monist apologist that although the non-dualist position is absolutely right, it is too right for ordinary people to get hold of. And they would probably give up their jobs if they could get hold of it. And therefore it is far better that they wrap themselves round with their illusions of the need for an external God, objectified, rather than that they realize that the absolute is itself the field running through all these objectified levels, and the same field is that which can be contacted at any point of it within an individual human being. If an individual human being identifies himself with this infinite field, he is automatically released from dictatorship by any other objectified zone of the field, because he defines all objectified zones as having authority only to the limits of their own perimeters. Which brings us back to the statement again, that if that protoplasm subdivides itself, because it is essentially the same throughout, no subdivided part of it has any authority to order any other part about. And therefore, if there is a large circle, it has no power to dictate to an inner circle, because the inner circle is essentially the same as the outer circle. Likewise, two circles within any given zone have no authority to dictate to each other externally. The center of infinity is everywhere, and the perimeter of infinity is nowhere. A man was burned at the stake for saying that, and it was worth being burned for, because he, having said it clearly, a lot of beings subsequently received the energy that he had put into it, and became themselves freer than they were from the dictating external forces. We see then that we can divide beings up at any cross section of time into beings that are saying yes to passivity and self-subordination to other powers, which may be necessary for the time, like a newborn baby says yes when its mother feeds it, provided it doesn't overfeed it. And it will take it some time before it has enough muscle strength and free intelligence to deny its parents their own way. Because we come into the world more or less helpless, we are dependent on beings outside our perimeter for our primary start in life. We should not be indebted to these people through whom we come into this world. We should only be indebted to what we are indebted to, namely to the infinite field. And this is why Jesus says, if the mother dictates the daughter and the father to the son and the daughter must revolt. I will set son against father and daughter against mother. I will break down all the family ties and the tribal ties and the national ties. Whatever ties there are, he says, I represent that absolute spirit which is free. And he says, I affirm that every being, no matter where it is, if it turns into its own center, is contacting in that inspirational center the same power that is of the absolute, and is in fact the absolute at that center functioning. When we have the courage to turn into ourselves in this way and feel no, sentience means feeling and knowing, when we feel no ourselves adequately in that way, we can always respond adequately in any similar situation. And if we go to the perimeter of our body and try to find out what to do there, we will find that the contingent stimuli of other people acting upon us will color our responses and will subordinate us to them. So the whole of our evolution should be, if we wish to become free, to become more and more aware of this inner feeling of self-determination. Now, when we come to consider the relation of man in his parts, we discover that there is this hierarchy, that there are centers in the body which give orders and which, if removed, the man dies. And there are other large masses of the body that can be cut away without the man dying. The essential order parts are obviously more important because we can survive with them and live adequately with those centers. In society, the same thing is true. Those men and women, of course, who have actually gained more response capacity by widening and deepening their self-knowledge, those beings factually are becoming centers of initiative. They are initiating changes in that social body as they do in their individual bodies. The more beings can become self-determinate within themselves, the more enlightened society as such becomes. Because society is nothing other than the gathered together individuals working under some governing concept which they themselves will. Now you know that in the political field we have in this country roughly three parties, Conservative, Liberal and Labour. We have done this before. We said we put Labour in the belly and Liberal in the heart and Conservative in the head. These are the three parts of man. And we have a coordination line, the spinal cord, which keeps these three working together. This spinal cord is like the government behind the three-party government, the government that never changes, the government that switches from Conservative to Labour or Liberal at will in order to divert those who don't know any better from the major issues, the major decisions to be taken nationally and internationally. This is a four-part man embodying four functions of this field. The four functions correspond with four different aspects of the field force. Wherever there is sentience, there is power. Wherever there is power, there is sentience. These two are proportional to each other. This is why we say that consciousness is a catalyst. The more sentient we become, the more we can feel, know, our being, the more power we discover. Now, we talk about the left wing as the have-nots. This is borrowed from heraldic symbology, where a shield, when it is parted, has the sinister side here, dark, and the dexter side, light. And on the sinister side are blazoned the characters belonging to the wife, and on the dexter side, to the husband. And the husband is said to be a have, and the wife is said to be a have-not. And in the same way, all the poor things in the world are said to be on the left or sinister side of society. And therefore, the labor department is said to belong to the have-not. And the conservative department, which uses its head powerfully and rationally to gain things in the world, is said to be dexterous or right-handed, and to be the hand. And we have a battle between the hands and the have-nots. The hands are those who have cunningly used their heads to rob the have-nots of what might have been theirs if they had used their heads too. But between these have-nots, these belly people, and these hands, these head people, are some heart people, and these heart people are either struggling upwards from the labor level to the conservative, because they themselves are fundamentally misdirected, or they are aware that the haves and the have-nots are equal and opposite, and both bound in a very peculiar way. So in between the belly and the head, we have the zone of liberation or freedom or liberality. Now, this is very important, because in the feeling, in the heart, in the compassion zone, is that which, in fact, can say of the have-nots. They have meaning only in relation to the haves, and the haves have meaning only in relation to the have-nots. And the meaning of not having is the same as non-existence, and the meaning of having is the same as existence. And so, if we posit a circle and say that is have, and we point to the space beyond the circle and say that it's have not, and the have is having existence and being, and the have not is the infinite beyond it, then there is a very curious sense in which the voice of the people is the voice of God, because the have nots are actually conferring significance upon the have. But the liberal or free being knows that it is absolutely essential to be free to affirm both the haves and the have-nots, to affirm that existence is a fact, and that this fact has no validity except as in opposition to non-existence. Dome is the same as existence, and free is the same as the beyond existence. Insofar as we have energy locked up in finite rotating forms, we exist and have a center of reference, a center through which we can make finite temporal evaluations. But if we have nothing other than this, we can never change. The rotating systems of energy within our being must go on repeating themselves throughout all time. Any closed system of energies reaches a level of equilibrium, and if no other force is added to it to change it, it then lapses from stimulus threshold level and ceases to be an object of consciousness. Constant stimulation equals no stimulation. Consequently, we must posit beyond any finite being, no matter how rich it is, that there is a transcendent, free, infinite force which can enter this finite system and break it up and force it to change and to absorb new energies to make new patterns. So the free man affirms that the existence finite have not, and the infinite have, and the reverse of these, the finite have has finite power, finite form, finite substance, and the infinite which has no finite whatever. These haves and these have-nots are equal and opposite and must be both affirmed, one to make a dome or center of reference for consciousness, and the other to supply the free energy to break up the equilibrated form which arises from the continuous spinning of the power within that finite zone.